practice her travel journal.
You're listening to BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Now we find ourselves once again with the iconic figure Sigmund Freud, who is taken up with the canine world in another reading from The Death of Sigmund Freud by Mark Edmondson.
While Hitler and his minions dominated the streets of Vienna, Freud laboured an hour a day on his Moses book, a book he hoped would stand as part of his 20-year analysis on the kind of debased authority that Hitler represented. But he was also devoting time to another literary pursuit. He and his daughter Anna were collaborating on a translation from French to German of Princess Marie Bonaparte's book about her dog, Topsy. The book was called Topsy, Chow Chow au Poil d'Or, Topsy, the Golden-Haired Chow. Like the princess, Freud was devoted to chows, long-haired, handsome, highly intelligent dogs. His most famous chow, Joe Fye, was his constant companion, sitting at the foot of his consultation couch while analysis was in session, panting away rhythmically. Patients noticed that the combination of Freud's cigar smoke and Joe Fye's dog smell made the consulting room a place singular and memorable, though not entirely agreeable. Bad smells or not, Freud adored his dog. After he underwent an especially painful surgery, he wrote to Marie Bonaparte, "I wish you could have seen with me what sympathy Joe Fye shows me during these hellish days, as if she understood everything." Freud's deep affection for dogs sometimes resembles that of his great precursor, Schopenhauer, who said that he would rather converse with his dogs than with most people. Like Schopenhauer, Freud's dog obsession probably arose from a mild misanthropy. Hitler's dog obsession signalled a misanthropy that was not so mild. On January the 11th, 1937, Joe Fye entered hospital to have a pair of ovarian cysts removed. She came through the operation well enough, but on January the 14th, died unexpectedly of a heart attack. On the following day, Freud acquired another chow, Lun. In March of 1938, when the Nazis invaded Austria, beloved Joe Fye was gone, and Lun reigned supreme in the Freud household. Freud greeted the manuscript of the princess's book about Topsy with delight. "I love it. It is so movingly genuine and true. It is not an analytical work, of course, but the analyst's thirst for truth and knowledge can be perceived behind this production, too." About dogs, Freud had an odd belief. He thought they were creatures whose natures were entirely pure, untouched by civilization. "It really explains why one can love an animal like Topsy or Joe Fye with such extraordinary intensity, affection without ambivalence, the simplicity of a life free from the almost unbearable conflicts of civilization. Often, when stroking Joe Fye, I have caught myself humming a melody, which, unmusical as I am, I can't help recognizing as the aria from Don Giovanni. The bond of friendship unites us both." Freud adored the book, which is also the story of an illness. Like Freud, Topsy has cancer. Both are afflicted with tumours on the right sides of their mouths. Like Freud, Topsy has surgery and is treated, as Freud will be, with Röntgen rays and radium. The conclusion of the book is all that the princess and Freud might have hoped. Topsy is cured. "She runs along by the sea, inhaling the wind and the storm." Topsy is reborn. Freud, sitting with Anna in his study going over their translation of the princess's book, could brood on the possibility of more life. Does Topsy realize that she is being translated? Freud asked the princess in a letter. Easter Sunday, April 1938, was the 52nd anniversary of the beginning of Freud's practice as a psychoanalyst. And it was a sad occasion, not least because Freud, who often thought of himself as a healer first, was no longer seeing any patients. It was not only patients that he had to give up. On April the 19th, he gave Alex, his brother, his stock of cigars. Freud called smoking a protection and a weapon in the combat of life, and was devoted to it. When in 1923 he discovered a cancerous growth on his jaw and palate, he refrained for some time from letting his doctors know. He was aware they would tell him he had to give up cigars. He did eventually let the doctors see the growth, and they gave him the expected medical advice. But Freud, being Freud, he ignored the doctors and went on smoking. Even after he gave his cigars to Alex, he would continue to smoke. On May the 6th, ill and disgruntled, Freud marked his 82nd birthday. He had never cared for birthdays. They brought intimations of mortality. So he decided to ignore it completely. His determination to get out of Austria was gathering force. To his son Ernst, an architect then living in London, he wrote, "Two prospects keep me going in these grim times, to rejoin you all and to die in freedom." Also on May the 6th, the American ambassador to Berlin reported to the Secretary of State that there was one more matter to clear up, the settling of Freud's debts to the Verlag, the printing press that published Freud's books, before he would be allowed to emigrate. But that one matter was under the discretion of Dr. Anton Sauerwald. At the Verlag, Sauerwald, aspiring member of the Nazi Party, was reading Freud's work and finding out what a fascinating thinker the old man was. And reading through his private papers, Sauerwald realized that Freud was breaking the law. He was keeping money in foreign banks, not reporting it to the Nazis. The crime was punishable, at least nominally, by death. It occurred to Sauerwald that if he reported Freud, he would advance his own fortunes. There were figures high in the Nazi Party happy to do away with Freud, even now, at this last minute. A phone call to the offices of Goebbels or Himmler would almost certainly mean the arrest of Freud and his family. On the 21st of May, Freud received a statement about the value of his precious antiquities, a statement that would be the basis for tax he would pay to take them out of the country. The collection was undervalued at 30,000 Reichmarks. The curator of the Viennese Museum of Cultural History had done him the good turn of pricing them at a low rate so as to keep the tax on them within Freud's means. His obsession with his antiquities had increased that spring. He spent time putting his books and statues in order, and even began to catalogue them. Odd for someone as unsystematic about things as Freud was. Marie Bonaparte, who sat on the stairs every day after Anna was arrested, making sure that the Gestapo did not come and take away the professor, soon smuggled his favourite treasure. A bronze statue of Athena, little more than 4 inches high. Athena's left hand is poised to grip a spear, which was lost. In her right hand she holds a libation bowl. The statue had a special place in Freud's heart, symbolizing wisdom and martial prowess. Marie Bonaparte held it for Freud at her home in Paris to present to him after he was finally free. Still, Freud did not have his statement of no impediment, indicating that all debts and taxes had been paid. The Germans put Freud in the same position they put many Jews. They took all he had, then demanded that he pay taxes on it. What Freud needed at this point was ransom money, pure and simple. Now Marie Bonaparte was compelled to do more than to rescue the statue of Athena. She stepped in and paid off the criminals masquerading as officials, and finally, Freud was free to go. On Saturday, June the 3rd, Sigmund Freud boarded the Orient Express with his wife Martha, his daughter Anna, a doctor, the housemaid, and Lun, his chow. The train made its slow way across Germany to the border of France, and Dr. Anton Sauerwald, for whatever reason, did not intervene. When the train crossed the Rhine, Freud offered a simple remark. Jetzt sind wir frei. Now we are free. Behind him, he left four sisters, too old to travel, under the care of friends. He left a population of Jews that would be virtually destroyed. On Monday, June the 6th, 1938, at 9:05 in the morning, Freud stepped down from a train at Victoria Station, London. The train had pulled into a far corner so that he could avoid the crowd gathered to greet him. His escape had been reported in the British newspapers, and there was public enthusiasm for his arrival. Though the weather was mild, he wore a densely woven three-piece suit, a heavy topcoat, a fedora, and thick black shoes. Freud insisted that he wanted to see something of his new home, so Ernest Jones, his most loyal retainer, drove him north, where the new residence was, through the centre of London. On an average day, Freud would see as many as 500,000 people on their way to work in what was now the largest city in the world. But it was Whit Monday, and most people had the day off. Freud, coming into London, saw a flow of cars heading out of the city, off in the direction of the seashore. That morning, the beaches were filling with girls displaying the latest fashion, silk or knitted snow-white hoods, inspired by the recently released Disney movie. Looking out of the window, he saw a London relaxed and confident. Yet a recent occurrence that had most transfixed Londoners was not the annexation of Austria, but the bombing of Guernica. The Germans, allied with Franco and his Spanish fascists, were using Spain to train their soldiers and try their new weapons. And at Guernica, the Basque town in the north of Spain, the weaponry succeeded beyond all expectations. The attack occurred on a market day and resulted in the slaughter of men and women and children too. The British, preoccupied as they might have seemed with Snow White and holiday going, were in a state of fear. They thought London could become Guernica on a grand scale, at least if Neville Chamberlain couldn't arrange to placate Hitler.
Anton Lesser was reading from The Death of Sigmund Freud by Mark Edmondson, which was produced by Duncan Minchell. Tomorrow, at the same time, an alluring garden in St John's Wood.
I am a consulting detective. I suppose I'm the only one in the world.
There's no one quite like Sherlock Holmes.
I say, that fellow in the street. I wonder what he's looking for.
Well, we shall soon see. He's coming to our door. Come in.
Yes?
My name is Sherlock Holmes.
I say.
I fancy an explanation is approaching at high speed.
New to BBC Radio 4 Extra, we present a selection of Sherlocks from the archives, including Robert Powell, Carlton Hobbs, and Sir John Gielgud.
Good evening, Watson. Have you a cigarette for me?
Well, Holmes, what about that?
There will be some fun over this case if they're both put upon the scent.
The Holmes Service, starting with The Study in Scarlet, on Saturday afternoon at 4.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 3 o'clock. Good afternoon.